Hello and welcome to another comedian's interview for my blog and podcast, A Rich Comic Life. My blog describes my experiences of watching over 1,000 comedians over the last 47 years. My special guest today is the wonderful Mr. Tony Demer, also known as Ronnie Golden. Yes!
Yay!
Hello.
Hiya. Yeah.
It's great to see you. How are you?
Yeah. Well, I'm not at my best at the moment, to be honest, because I about 10 days ago, I got this chest infection and hacking cough. Yeah. And it's not COVID. I tested for it. There's a lot of other nasty viruses out there. So if I suddenly break out into a horrible coughing jag, I do apologize, but
well, it's fantastic to see you. I hope you're better soon. We're going to spend the next 45 minutes to an hour or so, if that's okay, talking about your comedy career, because it is an illustrious one.
I always say the word career in my case is a verb.
Well, let's go right back to the start. And can you tell me, how did you become a musical comedian in the first place, please?
Well, actually, it's interesting you say musical comedian, because I always see myself as a funny musician, because music is my main pulse, if you like.
Yeah.
And always has been since I was a kid. I always wanted to be a songwriter and a singer and a musician, and the comedy sort of came out of that by accident in the early 80s with the alternative comedy thing. But my main pulse is really music.
Brilliant. That's great. So did you start off in the clubs as a musician? Is that how you began? You're in a lot of bands, were you? Or you're in specific band?
Well, as most people did, I mean, this is like the late 60s. I was, you get a band together with your schoolmates, and when I left school, we still carried it on for a few years. And, I had a bizarre thing, because, myself and my musical partners, we were called the Circus. And we got employed by three girl singers called the Chantels. It's mad. We didn't deserve it. We really didn't deserve it. But they were kind of desperate for a band, because their band, the Corsairs, had broken up the day before, and they had a big tour of American bases in Germany. And they had to get a band together very quickly. And I could tell when they heard us that they were deeply disappointed, because we really were pretty rubbish. But as a consequence, we ended up touring Germany on American bases. It felt like being in America, because they had all these kind of cafeterias and jukeboxes, and they were playing all the music of the day, which I loved, all the kind of soul stuff, Aretha Franklin and Booker T and the MGs. And we did that, and a payoff to that was in the late 60s, you had big kind of cinemas and theaters that closed on Sundays, and they would open it up for just a one night stand. So we ended up opening shows for Tom Jones, Scott Walker, Engelbert Humperdinck. And it was really weird, because we didn't deserve it, but they were so desperate to get us, and we'd open the show with a Shaken Finger Pop, which was Junior Walker and the All-Stars. And the main thing about them is that they had a saxophone player and we didn't, so I had to kind of ape the sax solos on guitar. But it was such an amazing learning curve.
I was just going to say, did you study music at college, or how did
I still can't read a note of music.
Wow.
I've written hundreds of songs, but I just trust my ears. I kind of, you know, I've got that natural sense.
So your musical career, this would be late 60s. That's when it started.
I'd have been 18 or 19.
I was born in 1967.
Oh, Lord. The summer of love.
So I may have just been an idea. So you're going along 4 or 5 years doing your band gigs. When did the comedy kick in? When did you think you could carve a career out of it? Was there a moment where you thought, I can do this well?
Well, it actually came off the back of being in a band called Fabulous Poodles in the late 70s. Right. We didn't do very much here, but we toured Europe a lot. We were quite big in Holland, and then we got signed up to Epic Records in the States. So we did 2-3 month tours there. We were opening for Shana Na, the 1950s kind of parody band.
Yeah,
and we opened for the Ramones, for the Jay Giles band.
Oh, how cool are you?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And then the next year we did another 3 month tour, opening for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, which was great.
Yeah.
Which is really good. And there was always an element of humor with us. I mean, a lot of the songs I wrote and co-wrote for the band were kind of ironic. I've never had a game plan. I didn't think, right, we're going to be a punk band and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
and we never were a punk band because the songs I wrote were kind of stretched over a very broad canvas, really. I'd write a country song. I'd write a pretty full-on rock song like Bionic Man, it was very broad, and it fitted the American market more than it did here, because they saw us as the new Kinks. It couldn't be better, really.
Yeah.
And so we did pretty well over there. But, you know, when you're playing smaller clubs in this country, you can afford to stretch out the humor. We used to take requests from the audience and we do them in different styles.
Sure.
And it was there was always an element of real strong entertainment in what we did. So when the band folded around 1981, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And then somebody introduced me to the comic strip, and they said, you should go down there and do something there. So I went down and auditioned, and I didn't think anyone would know me. And everyone was like really amazed. Wow, we got one of the Fabulous Poodles here, you know. And so I started doing that, and I was working with Rick and Aid and Jenny and Dawn and Ben Elton. And I was probably on the bill with Ben when he did his first ever kind of comedy performance.
Wow.
And I was doing the music spot then. I would do a couple of comedy songs throughout the show, but then I developed Patter, which a lot of people like Billy Connolly and Jasper Carrot, that's how they developed, really.
Yes, of course.
And, but there was never any kind of, I never thought, like, I'm a comedian now. It's just what happened.
Wow. Well, my home city's Carlisle, and I've been in London for 30 years, and my first comedy store gig featured... I think Richard Morton was on the bill. Linda Smith was on the bill. God bless her. Phil Peters, John Maloney. This would be 1988, something like that.
Right.
And but it had been going since 1979. So you were there in the very early days.
Yeah.
It just about opened. And we went last night. We saw Ian Stone compare last night, and he's walking down those famous stairs, the amount of photographs and everything on the walls are incredible. Yeah. Must have been an amazing time.
It was, but I mean I mean, this is kind of that's almost like glossy compared to what it was initially. It was a strip club, and there was this one lift that took no more than four people up into the area, and there'd be these naked women grabbing their clothes and rushing off, and we'd go in the dressing room, and it was a really different situation.
But I mean, every great thing has a start, you know, and going through 40 years, nearly 50 years now, it's an extraordinary thing that the comedy store was one of the first. Well, it was the first comedy club I came to in London, and I thought, this is extraordinary, you know. And that's how I started off in London, going to the clubs. What do you like to talk and sing about on stage? What I love about your style of comedy is that your songs are very intelligent and very clever, and you make the audience listen to the lyrics because they're so relevant.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. I mean, certainly with the Poodles, I wrote a song called B-Movies, which everyone said, which actually does a roll call of B-movie stars, British B-movie stars. And everyone's going, no one in America is going to know who they are. You know? And I said, well, it doesn't really matter. And it became one of our most popular songs. I used to work in my dad's tobacconist shop when I was a teenager, and I got to and a lot of the cigarettes had very kind of evocative names, Craven A and Senior Service and all of that. And I was working with Barry Cryer. We worked together on and off for nearly 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I'd go over to his place and we'd say, right, what should we write about today? And I said, and Barry was a confirmed smoker right up to the end. And I said, let's write a song about smoking. So we said it in the 1950s when everybody smoked. I mean, every house, my house was filled with old Hoban fumes.
And my dad smoked like a chimney, God bless him.
Exactly. I mean, everybody did. So we wrote this song called Love at First Light, which really, I say we wrote, I wrote it. He came up with one line in it. I'm just trying to remember, what's a line? Oh, I mean, we won't get into that. But you know, he came up with a title, which was great, and then this one line. But it's a song, and it really is. It's full of like old allusions to cigarettes that you could buy at the time. And again, I said to people who kind of criticized me, I said, well, you know, I got into rhythm and blues when I was like 14, 15, and I didn't know what a mojo hand was. I didn't know what a John Le Conqueror was. These are kind of voodoo terms that a lot of the kind of Southern blacks used. And for me, they were really evocative of their lives and their time. So I think, you know, you got to trust people to actually find out about it.
This is the wonderful thing, though, because when you say you wrote a song about smoking, it's so relatable. And as soon as you've got the lyrics in place, everybody can recognize it. Oh, yeah, this is great. And you're in and you're listening. And it's a magical way to get across what you're trying to say to people, you know, in a lot of you. I've noticed this in a lot of your songs. And also when the band are on stage as well. Tell me, how did Ronnie and the Rex come about?
Well, that came about because I'd had a few years where I really wasn't playing music, and I was comparing at Jongleurs Comedy Club in South London when there was just one. It's now a kind of brand that stretches across the UK, and I'd be introducing people, doing bits of stand up. Sometimes I do the occasional song with a ukulele or something, but I really missed the kind of the thwack of the snare drum and the bass and all of that. So a friend of mine was moving to America to San Francisco, and I I got a band together to just like a little 60s soul dance band for his leaving party. And we ended up getting offered the Gilded Balloon in Edinburgh. And we became a regular fixture there for Leighton Live. We started Leighton Live there. And
been there many times. Yeah.
Yeah, we stopped doing it after a few years because it just got so tiring. I mean, we wouldn't go on stage sometimes till like, you know, half one, 2 in the morning, and you come off at 4. It really was tiring. So we kind of went, so we knocked it on the head. But that's really how it started. And it's still, I mean, we hardly work these days because it's a 6-piece band.
Yeah.
And everyone wants tribute acts, 80s tribute acts and all that. And that's not our thing. It was very much kind of New Orleans based, kind of funky stuff, little bits of country-ish. I mean, it was different to what everyone else was doing, but it's a brilliant band, you know, good horn.
Oh, superb. Absolutely. I've seen them many times, and credit to everybody who's in there. They are so, it reminded me of Alex Horn's horn section where the comedy is there, but those people can play those instruments. They really can. And can I just say as well, my regular comedy club that I go to every week is Always Be Comedy with James Gill, right? He's the compere. And I sit on the front row, and sometimes he gets me up and asks me to sing, right? And of course, the joke is I can't sing a note. So I am so in awe of you that you can do it. It's magic. So anyway, let's move on. How do you cope, if at all, with any nerves before you go on stage?
Well, you somehow subsume it into the kind of confidence or fake confidence bullshit, what you want to call it, and when you go out on stage. I mean, I used to find that with Barry. We would pace around every night. We'd pace around, and he looked at me once and he said, "It never leaves you. The kind of the fear, the possibilities of everything going wrong." And of course, as soon as you step out on stage, it's particularly if you're working with somebody like Barry, because you know he engenders so much love from an audience, and it was great. And then you kind of look at each other and go, "Yeah, it's going to be all right."
I was honored to interview the great man just before he passed on, and he was an absolute joy to interview. It was literally, what was it like working with so-and-so? What was it like working with so-and-so? And the stories were just incredible. Can you tell me how you came to meet him, how that started off?
Well, a friend of mine took me along to see. He was doing a show that was written by Dick. Oh God, what's his name? Dick, American guy. Anyway, who is a brilliant writer, incredibly witty.
Is it Dick Vosborough? Is it
Dick Vosborough? Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And he was doing a thing called A Saint She Ain't, and he played W.C. Fields.
Right.
And Pauline Daniels, who's an extremely funny Northern comedian, played Mae West.
Right.
And it was a lovely little show. It was a small show, but it was great. And I went to meet him afterwards, and we chatted, and we got on fine. And then, I don't know, it might have been 2-3 years later, I'm doing a series of Radio 2 comedy shows called The Right Time with my band. And I have to write a new song, sometimes two, every week. And this is in the days when the BBC sent you a car. Now it's like, get your ass down here and the tube, you know. And then my mobile goes, and it's Barry. And I went, oh, hi. He said, yeah, I've just been offered a week in the Edinburgh Festival at the Traverse Theatre. And I fancy doing a kind of music and comedy thing. I've been listening to your CD. Would you fancy doing it? I said, well, let's get together and have a chat. So we got together and had a chat, and we worked with John Dowie. Do you remember
Yeah,
John Dowie?
knowing well, yeah.
Yeah, he's a very old friend of both mine and Barry's, and he directed it and co-wrote a few of the songs. And then Barry goes back and I stay on and my mobile goes again. And he said, I enjoyed that so much. Do you fancy doing it again next year? And I said, well, yeah, but we don't need the rhythm section because, you know, they're comedy songs and it'll save us money. You know, So I scrapped the two guys out of Ronnie and the Rex, and we just did it, the two of us, and it worked better because the humor came across much stronger. Yeah. And we just carried on working like that for years.
What you can see when you watch the two of you together was how well you complemented each other. He is such a great gag teller and can produce a joke from thin air. Yeah. I can see you doing all sorts of things with your guitar, and you're looking over here when you're playing. You play guitar backwards. It was a wonderful. We're moving on to Edinburgh. We have talked a bit about it. I am very fortunate to be able to go to the Edinburgh Fringe every year. I've been going since 2005, and it's my holiday. I go for a week. I see a load of shows, and since 2005. I've been making a point of seeing you and Barry every year. So it was wonderful to be able to watch the shows every year and watch you all develop. I met him twice, but I never had a photograph with him. I do like to have photographs with all the comedians. he was very, very complimentary about you. So and he said he's a perfect partner to work with. So
he was. I mean, I think in a way we became really good friends.
Yeah.
And the main thing is that what bonded us, I think, more than anything, was a love of jokes. And jokes at one time and probably still are seen as a kind of like you know, a lot of younger comedians think jokes are just rubbish, but jokes are great because they're like folk songs, folklore.
Yeah.
And we used to write jokes, and sometimes Barry would hear a joke. He loved parrot jokes.
Yes.
And if he heard a new parrot joke, he'd call me up and he'd tell me. I mean, you know, these are the things that you really miss about me.
Yeah, he would ring comedians, ring up every time. I had to ring him on his phone to get him on my podcast. It was hilarious. Hello, is that Richard? Yes, is that Mr. Cryer? You know what I mean? Oh, I've been having a look at your blog. It's quite good. Let's do that. He was lovely, just the best. But
he was
one of the greatest.
And he was a genuinely nice guy. Yeah. And he was always interested in everything. I mean, a lot of comedians from his generation, they cut off when alternative comedy started, whereas he suddenly, his antenna were up and he just thought, oh, this is really interesting.
Yeah, that's the magic thing. It's like my blog, I've documented every comedian I've ever seen, and part of it is watching them grow and develop. And he was wonderful at that. The support that he gave to everybody, regardless of who they were, was extraordinary. So there you are at the Edinburgh Festival year after year after year. Did you both collaborate in writing the songs? I'm particularly thinking of classics like Peace and Quiet and things like this. Was the collaboration there? Did he write the lyrics? Did you write the music? Or was it just, did it just happen?
It did vary. It's kind of interesting. I was talking about songwriting to somebody the other day, and I said, if you're writing with someone else, you are either the secretary or you're the pacer. And when I work with John Dowie, oddly enough, he's the secretary and I'm the pacer. So you just come out with whatever you think of the top of your head, and he'll either go, that's crap, forget it, or that's really good, we'll have that. And so I was the pacer. But with Barry, I was the secretary and he was the pacer. and he'd be coming out with stuff. But it really did vary, because sometimes he'd come up with an absolutely brilliant word for word lyric, and I would say, "That's great, Barry," and I would write the music to it. And that's pretty much how Peace and Quiet came out. That was John Dowie's idea. He said, "Why don't we do a song that eulogizes over the idea of silence and peace and quiet, and the only joke is it just gets louder and louder till there's just two old blokes on stage screaming their lungs out." And we immediately went for that. And I mean, of course, John gets the credit on it, even though he didn't write a word, because it was his idea. It was, you know, he was great. And Barry actually wrote a gag into it, where it was like, "With my Atkins diet, peace and quiet." And then he kind of went, "Oh no, that's a joke. We don't want a joke in this song. We want it to sound like a kind of like a hymn." So we scrapped anything that resembled a joke in it and made it sound like a really serious anthemic song. And it worked much better. But that was Barry's genius, really. He knew Absolutely. That stuff.
Well, it was a joy to watch you perform it with Harry Hill at Barry Pryor's celebration on the 13th of June, which I went to. Extraordinary night, and such a warm tribute to an absolute comic master. So,
yeah, it was a lovely night.
Much missed. Okay, let's move on. To date, what do you think has been your comedy highlight in your long career, or your musical highlight in your long career?
That's a tough one.
On the spot.
There's been quite a few lowlights as well, I have to say. I mean, certainly getting together with Barry was a really good thing. I opened for Tommy Cooper at the Albany Empire in Deptford in the mid 80s, that was. And it was pretty shortly before he went. And that was incredible. And Lenny Henry was there. And I knew Lenny anyway, because I'd toured Ireland with him. And at one point, Lenny just gets up and points out this little gate that Tommy has on stage, and he said it needs to be more over there. So the guy went, "Okay." I mean, you know, Lenny knew Tommy's act probably better than Tommy did.
Yeah,
and he did. He just, you know, I mean, it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And I remember afterwards, some friends of mine wanted his autograph, so I waited outside his dressing room door, and I knocked on the door, and I said, "Mr. Cooper, I was your opening act tonight, and it was a wonderful show. I wonder if I could ask you for a few autographs." And he was sitting bowed over with no shirt on, and steam was rising off.
Wow.
And I kind of knew that he was dying then. I knew that he didn't have long. It was just an instinct. And I got it.
The early 80s, would it? Yeah.
No, this was later. This was about 85 or something.
All right. Yeah.
And he signed the things, and I just got it, and I burst into tears, because I just kind of knew.
Yeah.
He was on the way out.
I mean, it was tragic when he went, because the whole, it was on the television, live from Her Majesty's, and I'll never forget it, because, of course, the audience thought he was still doing the act when he.
I know. Do you know, I saw that again recently.
Yeah, horrible. I the first ever comedy show I saw was Les Dawson in 1975 on
Holy Grail.
Family, he was amazing, and then a year later we saw Tommy Cooper, and that gave me the bug for the thing. When we saw him, the curtains opened, and he's lying on a bed. There's nothing else happening. He's just lying on a bed, and one woman in the audience cries with laughter, and it trickles round. And after about 5 minutes, he pops his head up. He goes, "What? What? Somebody, come on!"
I know.
Got up and stuff. I don't think he realized. I like to think I don't think he realized he was as funny as he was, because he was so, but he knew exactly those magic tricks and all the rest of it. But
I think he did. I reckon he did, because you couldn't do that stuff unless you knew that you kind of embodied humor, which he certainly did. I mean, going back to 1975, actually earlier, 69, the first comedy I ever saw, and I was, what, 20, about 20 years old, it was Max Wall.
Wow.
And Max Wall was working in this kind of music hall pub in Edmonton. And it kind of really changed my life in lots of ways. I thought, I don't quite understand this, but I think it's brilliant. And I became an absolute devotee of Max Wall. And I remember he was doing a series of shows at the Shaw Theatre in Houston.
Yeah.
Around 75. And they were just genius. I mean, you'd go in and he'd be sitting on the edge of the stage in a battered straw hat and dangling his legs, and people would be finding their seats, and he'd just go, let's have a look at your ticket. Sit over there. And he'd do this brilliant 2-hour show, and at the end he'd go, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight you have been 50%. He said, I've been 50% and you've been 50%. I thought that was a brilliant way of looking at a show, that, you know, it takes a really good audience to make a show.
Genius.
And he was fantastic. And I actually was, John Dowie wrote a pilot show, which I was in. I put the music together for it. And Max played the devil in it. And it was Max's last ever TV thing. Because I mean, Max was a musician as well. I mean, he was a really good jazz guitarist. He wrote hundreds of songs, and I think he was possibly number one on the Stiff record label when he covered Ian Dury's England's Glory.
How brilliant is that? I am a massive Stiff Records fan. My favorite band are Madness, but I loved Ian Dury and the Blockheads. They were amazing.
Oh God, yeah, the brilliant band.
Yes. Do you have any more ambitions as a comedian or singer? Do you think you're very happy with your lot now? You're very happy gigging around when you want to, or do you want to be on television hosting a quiz show?
I definitely don't want that. I think too many comedians now, that's their goal.
Yeah,
my goal isn't even really being on TV. I just want to stretch myself. I'd like to do more. I'm actually co-writing a musical at the moment, which is called Unplugged, the musical, and it's I'm writing it with this American guy I know, who's a proper playwright. I wanted to get somebody who knew how to assemble the nuts and bolts of the thing, and we had a bunch of songs, and I'm writing new stuff. And it's set in a old musician's care home, basically, and it's got a kind of political undertow to it, which isn't too prominent. It's funny, but it's touching as well. And we're writing it for Fringe Theatre, so we didn't want anyone trying to control us and trying to tell us what to do. So, you know, fingers crossed, we'll get it on at the Battersea Arts Centre or something and see how it goes.
That is on my doorstep. I'll come and see you.
Oh, well, in that case, you're probably just down the road from me now, because I'm in Battersea.
Well, I live in Southfields.
So okay.
It's a 156 bus away.
Yeah. Nice. Well.
Well, there you are, my friend. So I'll look out for that Unplug the Musical, and I wish you all the best with it.
Well, I'll let you know when it's happening.
During the pandemic, have you done any online gigs or anything like that?
No.
Or no, it just didn't appeal to you at all.
No, I've done interviews a bit like this. I've done a number of those, but I don't think comedy works like that. Well, it's all about being in the room and, you know,
It's
the
all
smell and everything about it is, you know, it's I
the
no, I turned down a lot of opportunities there because I didn't like the idea. So, but you know, I've done musical ones. You know, where I do three or four songs and but no, I don't think stand up works on Zoom.
I think when the pandemic hit for me, I think it's a very good substitute for live comedy. You can't beat live comedy, and I love to go on a weekend to go to the comedy club, have a few drinks with my friends, and then you're in the moment live, and anything can happen.
Yeah.
With the online gigs, a lot of them did do them. And initially, there was no sound. They couldn't work out the audio. So I was sitting here laughing at four walls at the comedians. They couldn't hear me. I was laughing alone, and I thought I was going to be taken away.
Oh no, yeah.
But then they worked out how to do the audio, and you could see the comedians trying to get in step with the routines and try and get the
Yeah.
audience whatever. So I think if the ones that are done well work. But you cannot be live. You know, it's so good
No.
that we are back to hopefully some sort of normality, and the comedy clubs are open, thank God, and everybody's going to them. Who are your favorite comedians, past and present? Did you grow up watching a lot of comedy?
Yeah, I did. And also listening to it as like a school kid, I'd come home for lunch. And there'd be workers' playtime would be on. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Very much so, yeah.
And basically, it was that they put comedy shows on in the works canteen,
That's right.
and you had comedians of the day like George Martin, the casual comedian, and they all had their own little kind of slogan. And I used to love it. I am Jimmy Wheeler, and you had these comedians who play the fiddle really badly, and then they'd come out with a line, and then they go back to the. And I used to find it hilarious, and so it was kind of weird getting into comedy in the early 80s, being a you know relatively young man, because comedy always seemed like it was the domain of elderly people, like because all the comics were getting on when I was a kid, and so you didn't want to be that. You wanted to be Keith Richards. You wanted to be John Lennon. Yeah.
That's amazing, because when you said before about going along to the comic strip in the 70s at to the comedy store, I have seen so many comedians over the years, so many. And we were very lucky to see Rick Mayall in Carlisle, play Carlisle and deal with the Carlisle audience. And he was off stage at the start, and they had the theme to the Muppet Show and Dallas going on a loop. And then he jumped out and he went, "Ladies and gentlemen of the Carl," he kept calling Carlisle the Carl, "hello." And then his trousers exploded. And then he threw somebody out of the auditorium for not laughing. He was a one-off, but Ben
Yeah, he
Elton
was
also.
great.
It must have been fascinating. Like we was talking before about Barry Cryer supporting them. You must have seen a lot of comedians whilst your career was going along.
Sure, I mean, I remember going along and seeing Rick Anade and Nigel Planer and Peter Richardson, the Outer Limits, and yeah, it was all a kind of new thing. And also, I got really friendly with Rick because he was just such a great character, and of course, he got me into the Young Ones. I played Buddy Holly, hanging
Of course.
upside down from the ceiling of Mike's room, and mildly legendary kind of TV thing, but
Brilliant.
that it was a very exciting time because I think like punk rock, Nobody kind of knew what they were doing. And
Yeah,
when
yeah.
people don't quite know what they're doing, they're inventing it. And when you're inventing it, it's fresh and it's great. I mean, I think the trouble with a lot of comedy now is it's been absorbed into the mainstream. And people love it, but I can't be bothered with it because it's like, you know, I remember when it was exciting. I mean, the early days of the Comedy Store, I mean, the strippers would be on and then the comedy wouldn't start till after midnight.
Yeah.
And so everyone, the audience is all drunk when they came in and they're all yelling stuff out. And I remember a time when one of the performers, Steve Dixon, jumped off stage and nutted a guy in the front row. And there was just claret everywhere. And you go, and I'm thinking, blimey, punk rock was pretty wild, but this.
But that's the magic of it. It's the originality of it all. Like I said before, it's like something unique. And what is going to happen? And that's the exciting bit of it all. I've so much enjoyed talking to you. I could talk all day. Is there anything else you would like to say before we go? Where can people find you on social media? Have you got any gigs planned or anything like that? Or you were saying about the planning the musical before?
That's taken up a fair bit of time. And I'm also writing a memoir at the moment called Everybody's Poodle, Nobody's Bitch.
Brilliant.
which is kind of covering music. I'm not sure if it's going to be two volumes. I think I'll try and make it into one thick volume, you know. And I'm covering a lot of area there. I didn't want to do it to start. And then my oldest friend I've known since I was 10 kept on at me. He said, and I said, yeah, but still nobody really knows who I am, so they're not going to buy it. And he said, no, but that might be the selling point, that, you know, I'm a kind of Zelig of the comedy and rock and roll worlds. You know, I never – Barry always said the same thing. We were both kind of marginal people in our own spheres. And he said, Ronnie Corbett, who was his best mate, he said, I don't know which – run of the showbiz ladder you're on, Barry, but stay there because it suits you. And I think that's true. Don't aim too high, just kind of be comfortable.
Well, you have brought joy over the years to myself and my friends who have gone to the Edinburgh Fringe and seen you year and year, year after year after year. You are
good.
One of my favorite people who are in the Fringe. And I wish you every single success. I really do. I think
Thank
what
you.
You do is wonderful to entertain audiences. So all the very best to you. And I, for one, will be buying that book and going to see your new musical. All the best
I'll
to you.
I'll let you know.
Please do. And you take care. All the best to you.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks now. Bye-bye.